on Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA. It's The Buzz with Dr. Z, supported by the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. Dr. Z is Dr. George Lupko, founder and director of the foundation. Now, here's WRTA's Doug Herentine and Dr. George Lupko.
And thanks for joining us. Thank you, Dr. Zlupko, for being here.
Thanks, Doug. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
And if you were listening to the promotional announcements for this particular program, some people may have said, like you said, the idea of something called popcorn lung, it sounds kind of flippant, and it's absolutely not.
Yeah, that's correct. It's a serious problem.
Well, why don't you explain, and I did some reading from the American Lung Association website that explained why it's called popcorn lung, and I'm sure you were going to get into this, but it has a reasonable direction to that particular name.
Yeah, let me start off by telling the viewers or the listeners a little bit about the anatomy of the lung, because this is part and parcel of why this problem is so terrible. The lung is composed really of two basic segments. It's the conducting airways, and then there's the air exchange units, the tissue of the lung. So the conducting airways of the lung, you know, we have you have your windpipe, right? Everybody knows that. That's the one common pathway.
Trachea.
And then the trachea splits and continues to split both in the right and left side of the chest. Like a tree, there's branches, and then the branches get smaller, and then the branches get smaller, and then the branches get smaller until they get almost microscopic and actually do get microscopic. What you need to know is that the larger airways, okay, down to the bronchioles, have cartilage, okay, that stuff you can feel in your windpipe, you know.
You also have it in your nose.
Yeah, in your nose. It has cartilage.
It's not a bone, but it
yeah.
It shapes that part of your...
Yeah, you know, you get it on the edge of a chicken breast or something like that. It's cartilage, right? And then it also has surrounding the airway, some muscle. In medical terms, it's called smooth muscle because it's different than striated muscle, but it's called smooth muscle. And that continues in those branchings until you get down to a certain point where there is no cartilage and no muscle. And once you get that way, those airways are basically small, very small, microscopic, composed of maybe sometimes just one cell layer. Now, where that's important is this. When you have a disease that affects the airways, let's say COPD or asthma, that's affecting the airways. We have medications that are able to deal with the central airways, the so-called central airways. Those medications relax that muscle. Those medications reduce inflammation in the lining, okay, and reduce the mucus production. When you get down to the very tiny ones, the ones that are almost microscopic and are microscopic, you don't have that. There's nothing there to attack. There's no medicine there to do anything with those because there's no muscle there. Okay? Mm. And the lining is only a single lining. It doesn't really have the mucus-producing cells and everything like that. So just consider that anatomy first, okay?
How it gets smaller and smaller.
Smaller and smaller, but it also gets to the point where there's no smooth muscle around it, no muscle that can contract or relax, so we don't have any treatment, okay, to do that for those tiny airways. And as far as inflammation and mucus production are concerned, they don't have that down there. They don't have any mucus production, but they can get inflamed, okay?
It would almost be like they're passive and unsupported as opposed to the supported by the...
That's correct. That's correct. They're in the tissue of the lung. They're soft. Again, not being able to show you what a biopsy of the lung looks like, you can see them there. But these are the small, what they call bronchioles, okay? Now, you remember the Industrial Revolution?
Sure.
Did you fight in that? Did you?
No.
No.
No. I was a beneficiary of it. However,
right.
No,
you don't have the uniform for the Industrial Revolution. Well, when the Industrial Revolution came along, it created a huge problem with communicable diseases because, for first reason, people congregated then in cities because that's where the factories were and outside the cities where factories were. And so you were able to disperse various infections throughout the population. You had TB, you had typhus, you had even cholera, for example.
Well, let me give you an example closer to home, which I don't know if you were going to say. The railroad shops here. The shops here where you had people, and it still happens where at a certain time of day, thousands of people come walking out of the shop, thousands of the workers do, who had been in that contained and enclosed shop with all the equipment and all the, I don't want to say pollution, but just all the byproduct of everything that they're dealing with on the locomotives. And they were in that enclosed space, and they head off to maybe the community only a few blocks away back in the day.
Yeah, and don't feel bad about saying pollution because that's what was there. Again, part of the Industrial Revolution was that there was a dramatic increase in respiratory diseases in the United States. And some of those were related to infections and things that we transmitted to one another, okay? And there are common examples here. During the COVID epidemic, okay, these meatpacking houses where there were a lot of workers, you know, congregated inside
they were
factories. They were hot spots because they were able to communicate that to each other. The other thing that happened was workers were beginning to be exposed to significant pollutants, toxins, organic dusts such as asbestos and silicosis, silica dust, and coal dust, and other types of just general industrial flotsam and jetsam, you know, that's in the air. Okay. So in that time frame, in the Industrial Revolution, we saw a lot of this happening, and it was a big problem then in the United States from a medical point of view. In 1901, there was a major discovery, kind of, in one factory where the workers were exposed to nitrogen dioxide, and that caused a scarring disease in the lung. We were just in the early stages of using x-rays and whatnot, but it's at that point in time when this disease that we're going to talk about today really was first recognized as a disease. Now, we didn't have some of the science that we have today, but it was back in 1901 when this first was recognized as a disease entity. Since then, I'm going to tell you what the disease is in a second, but since then, it has developed the funny name of popcorn lung. And it does that because of the way it looks on your x-ray and a CAT scan, okay? But it goes back to the Industrial Revolution. This isn't something new, although there are some things now today that are making it much more common and much more apparent.
The disease has been there because we've had different things inflaming the lungs. At one era, it was this type of industrial situation. 50 years later, it was something else.
Right. And we're going to talk about where we first discovered what may be one of the primary causes of this, other than these other things that we talked about in the modern era, that happened about 25 years ago, back in Missouri. And I'll talk about that in just a little bit. So the disease popcorn lung, which is now what we call it, is really something called, the official name is called bronchiolitis obliterans. And you can write that down.
And it sounds ominous just listening to it.
Well, yes, it's bronchiolitis obliterans. And the reason that I gave you a description of the anatomy of the lung is because the disease process is in those tiny, tiny airways that do not have any cartilage, do not have any smooth muscle.
How many of those airways does the average person have?
Millions.
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 Because they're that minuscule.
Oh, yes. You know, if you would take the lungs stretch them out like tissue paper, right?
Yeah.
You would be able to cover a surface of about the size of a tennis court. That's the surface area where we exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide would be the size of a tennis court. And so to each one of these little alveoli, these little sacs where we have that exchange occurring, we have a little bronchiole that's going to it. Well, that's where the disease then occurs. And the consequences of that I'll discuss in just a little bit. But the process then is a disease brought on by initially what we thought was just environmental exposures and all. Now we know some other things about it. The disease is focused on those tiny little airways that are beyond the cartilage and beyond the smooth muscle.
The Buzz with Dr. Z, Dr. George Zupko, and it's supported by the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. We're talking about popcorn lung, and the doctor has explained kind of what that is, and it may seem, I don't know, sort of diminishing it or not taking it as seriously as possible when it's called that, but if you realize that it does indeed look like that. And the American Lung Association said there's another connection to that, why some people refer to it as popcorn lung, that we may or may not get to in the course of the program. It depends when Dr. Z wants to put that in.
We are absolutely going to get to it, Doug. That's the whole reason for calling it popcorn lung, and I'll talk to you about it in just a second. But before I do, I just want to go back a minute because you may not realize the inference of where this disease is located in the lung. Remember I told you that it is centered in those airways that do not contain any smooth muscle, any mm-hmm. cartilage, right?
Right.
Well, the inference there is that we don't have any medications to dilate those airways if they get inflamed and get narrowed. And if they scar down, there's nothing to reverse that scarring. So those little airways, the final endpoint of your large airway, the trachea.
Yeah.
Okay. When they scar down, that's it. That's the ball game. There's no medicine that we have that changes that.
It would be as if you've poisoned the root of a tree, and once the end root is cut or affected, that part of the root is never going to be able to bring water and nutrients back into the plant.
That's right. It's the very end result. It's the very end of the line, but once that gets damaged and destroyed, and so this disease process is irreversible and really has no treatment. Now, I'm not saying people haven't given treatments for it, okay? But none of them really do anything to reverse it.
At this point, you're just making people as comfortable as they could be made.
Exactly. If it affects your oxygen level, we give them oxygen. If it affects, you know, their chest wall or something like that, we give them some pain medicine. Whatever it does, however they're affected, we try and relieve that symptom. But in fact, there is no treatment for it. So that's what makes it a very serious disease. Okay, that's what makes it a serious disease because it is, you know, if you have asthma is a treatable disease. We give you some medicine, we open up your airways a bit, we can reduce the amount of mucus they produce, you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
There is no treatment for this. Once that damage occurs, it's done and done. And so trying to figure out what causes it, trying to prevent that is very important because there is no treatment, right?
Yeah.
Now, let's go to why they call it popcorn lung. This goes back to a discovery that occurred in employees at a food manufacturing company, the Glister Mary Lee Food Manufacturing and Distribution Company. This was in Missouri. It was about 25 years ago. And they had a whole bunch of factory workers who were coming down with very similar symptoms. They were coughing, and they were wheezing, and they were short of breath, and they were being treated for viral infections. They were treated for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Many of these patients or many of these workers never smoked. Mm-hmm. So they had a disease. Everybody was getting something that looked like it was some kind of obstructive airways disease. And it took a while, actually, to figure this out. Now, just to make a finer point on this, most lung troubles have the same symptoms. So it's, in other words, wheezing, coughing, shortness of breath.
So that, good luck narrowing it down.
Yeah, that's the trinity.
Yeah.
Okay, if you don't have one of those, you may not have any lung disease. You know, you may have some abnormality of your x-ray or something. But if someone walks into our office and doesn't have wheezing, coughing, shortness of breath, they may not be in the right office, you see. The lungs can only respond in a certain way to any insults, whether it's something from the outside, whether it's a disease. You're going to get the same kind of symptoms, wheezing, coughing, shortness of breath. So these patients were getting wheezing, coughing, shortness of breath. No one seemed to figure out what was going on. And it took a while. It took a while for this to occur. It took some pretty smart guys. What they found out was that these workers were exposed to a chemical called diacetyl. Diacetyl. Now, this diacetyl was present in a compound that was used to flavor popcorn. It was present in a buttery concoction, a compound that they used to flavor popcorn with, to make popcorn buttery. But it was like a dust, you know? And when they found out that diacetyl was the culprit, and where it was found, the moniker of popcorn lung got stuck with this problem of bronchiolitis obliterans.
But at least it was a quick way to explain it to people, whereas perhaps before you had to have the whole 20 minutes that you had in the lead up to this to explain it.
Well, yes.
But if you say popcorn lung and you explain why it looks like that, but also the fact that it was caused by people being around the manufacturer of microwave popcorn.
That's exactly it. Actually, if you look at the x-ray, and this is the hard part to explain to some folks, the x-ray really doesn't look like popcorn. It doesn't look like they threw popcorn in your lung. The label popcorn lung comes from this discovery in this factory, where they were making a buttery flavor compound that contained diacetyl. And it was that exposure, even though it was in large vats, by the way. And the vats were closed. It wasn't like this was just blowing around everywhere, but there was enough in the air. There was enough in the air that the workers were getting exposed to this, and this repeated exposure created this problem of bronchiolitis obliterans. And as I explained to you, this is a serious problem, because once you get it, you got it. There's no treatment for that other than to remove them from that exposure.
Now, from what the American Lung Association fact sheet on it said, they did remove this from most microwave popcorn that we know of, and from those processors and factories. The reason being
Diacetyl.
Diacetyl. I've seen numerous videos, whether I want to or not, on YouTube when the commercial comes on. This is the one thing you don't want to be eating. And they would say one of the things is microwave popcorn because of this ingredient. American Lung Association says that most of that is removed now. So there may be other reasons not to have microwave popcorn, although I can't think of them right now. It's better than eating 5 chocolate bars. But I don't know that that's something they're going to have to worry about, although it's apparently used in other things.
It is used in other things. We'll talk about that in a bit.
All right.
But
and you do want to stick around for it, because believe me, you know somebody that's using this product, or you are.
Well, the business about removing diacetyl is true. It's not removed from all products, though. There are some things that contain it, and we'll talk about that a little bit. I don't want to offend people who like popcorn. I don't want to offend the popcorn industry. If you want to make microwave popcorn, please make it. This was the buttery flavoring, so
yeah.
Maybe stay away from the buttery flavored popcorn, you know what I mean?
Although almost all nuclear popcorn, at least that's what we used to call it at work, has the buttery flavoring of some type. Whether it's actual butter, I'll leave up to you if you read the ingredients. But I don't know that you're getting that much of it when you're making popcorn in the microwave at home. Although, after hearing about popcorn lung, it does make me wonder if they hadn't removed that.
Well, you do have to get a reasonable exposure to it to get the disease. I mean, a few molecules of diacetyl are not going to give you this disease. But a constant exposure like you would in the workplace in these factories, yes, that would be a problem. That would be a problem. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the story of popcorn lung in terms of the name. All right. The other group of people, though, who tend to be exposed to or at risk for developing so-called popcorn lung, or let's call it bronchiolitis obliterans, as we really should from the medical point of view, are patients who are really sick from other things. These are patients who have bone marrow transplants or lung transplants. These patients get bronchiolitis obliterans in high percentages. The patients with who are bone marrow transplant patients, and remember, these are patients who are already sick because they're getting a bone marrow transplant because they have leukemia or they have some other hematologic disorder. We destroy their marrow, which I just can't imagine how that is, but we do. We destroy their marrow.
Weakens or obliterates the immune system.
Yeah, we give them a whole new marrow. About 10% of those patients will get bronchiolitis obliterans. It's just part of the immunologic reaction to that process. Patients with lung transplantation are even more at risk. About 50% of those patients will develop bronchiolitis obliterans within 5 years of their lung transplant.
What percentage?
50%. Okay. Now, here you go. You've transplanted your lung. You've taken out your lung. You put in other lungs because you want to breathe better, and you think, I'm okay. Forget about the fact that the five-year survival is very restricted in patients.
Possible rejection, et cetera.
All sorts of things. But even if everything works out well, okay, you're still, half those people will get this bronchiolitis obliterans. And remember what I'm telling you. It's of those tiny little, almost microscopic airways that once they are scarred down and closed, you can't open them up again. We don't have a medicine to do that. And so as much disease as you get, that's what you got, and you're going to live with that unless you have to be retransplanted or something like that.
You can make the decision. You can't live with the lungs you have. So you take a 50-50 shot at not having this, but even if you do, at least you're still alive.
Yeah, and if you remember, we did a show on lung transplantation, and,
right.
And this is one of the things that affects those kinds of folks, all right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I was at the point where, okay, if you have the lungs you have, you're going to die within, we figure, this amount of time, or you can try a transplant, I can see people going for it even with the idea of a 50-50 shot of this.
Oh, I'm not saying that you shouldn't if you're a candidate for a transplant.
Just be aware of it.
And, you know, but these are discussions that the transplant centers have with patients. Those discussions are really, really important, and they really do a good job because they really tell the patients, this is not the panacea here. You're signing up for a serious operation and for potential serious consequences, okay? So you're trading your lung disease for the diseases associated with your transplantation.
Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA. It's The Buzz with Dr. Z, Dr. George Lupko, supported by the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. We're talking about popcorn lung. We told you why it's called that. We'll recap some of that in just a bit. However, there is also the Black Lung Clinic, and we wanted to make mention of that and what that is through the foundation.
Yeah, we have the Black Lung Clinic. The U.S. Department of Labor through HRSA gives the Lung Disease Foundation a grant to evaluate patients with black lung disease or patients who are exposed to coal dust and may have black lung disease. And those evaluations are free. We do hundreds of patients a year. You contact the clinic. The ladies there and the directress there will sign you up. We fill out all kinds of forms for you. We will direct you to attorneys, which will help you if you qualify. And we check you against the statute that says you may be able to file a claim. And it's a free deal. And we actually are licensed to be in 41 counties in Pennsylvania. We are not physically there. We have folks who come to us all the way from Lackawanna County and up in the Scranton area, all those places, and some down south as well. And if you don't come through us, you end up having to go to West Virginia somewhere. That's the next place where someone like our clinic might be able to help you. So in any event, if you've been exposed to coal dust, if you were a coal worker, even if you don't have any symptoms at the present time, this can be a progressive disease. You may want to contact our clinic, have an evaluation, come by every couple years and have it redone. And so there's a phone number. It's 814-800-2309. 814-800-2309. And if you call there and talk to the secretary, she can hook you up.
And we will have that number on the podcast of this program up at WRTA.com a little bit later today. So you can check that there. And you can also, if you missed any part of our conversation about popcorn lung, you can hear it from the beginning. As far as where we were, we had said that there are some other products that are on the market that still use this chemical that was causing people who are working in the microwave popcorn plants a problem with their lungs. And I'm surprised that it would still be used anywhere for anything if people knew what this was. And especially the irony is, and I'm not trying to be funny, the irony is what it's being used for in some of these cases.
Yeah. Well, I guess we teased everybody enough. We'll tell them that this has to do with the habit of vaping, e-cigarettes and vaping. And you may recall, just before the COVID epidemic, there was a rash of lung diseases which were being discovered associated with vaping, so-called Evali. And these, it stands for e-cigarette ventilator-associated lung disease or something like that, okay? And those people who are having that were investigated to see what the reason was, what was going on. Well, what was going on is these nicotine products that are being inhaled through vaping, okay, contain diacetyl. Some of them contain diacetyl, particularly the flavored ones.
What in the world is it used for that they of all things, put it into something you're going to be inhaling after they knew about this?
Well, it's part of the, it's, well, why, I can't answer why, but it's part of the flavoring process, a part of the stabilization of the flavors.
For the buttered popcorn, it did the same thing for that it does for the flavors in e-cigarettes.
That's correct. And so, and it still does. It still does. Now, there's also some other compounds, of course, we know in vaping, in the cigarette smoke of vaping. And back in 2020, I think it was, there was also another rash of hospitalizations, 2,800 hospitalizations that year and 70 deaths for patients who developed some type of lung trouble, which they traced back actually to vitamin E acetate, so-called VEA. The point being is this, is that when you talk about lung disease caused by vaping, the problem you have is that there are multiple compounds that the user is inhaling. And so to say that vaping lung disease is caused by diacetyl or by vitamin E acetate is difficult because you need constant exposure for a long period of time. There are multiple compounds in this smoke, and to pin it on just one is difficult because you have to know how much of that they've inhaled.
I seem to recall some article that listed all of the ingredients in some vaping fluid, and it was as long as your arm.
Oh, there's a lot of them. It's not water vapor that you're inhaling.
Which is what I've always heard when people defend it to me. And at first I thought, well, this makes some sense. It's just harmless water vapor. See, it's not smoke. It's not, you don't have to worry about it. But it's still going into your lungs.
Yeah. Well, to put a fine point on it, it has to do with this diacetyl. It may have something to do with vitamin E acetate. But the point is that that particular habit, if extended over a period of time, and we know that smokers are smokers many times for long periods of time, if you're inhaling vaping products for, say, 10 years or more, we're going to see the effects that these compounds have on your lung. And if you have, if you're developing bronchiolitis obliterans, you're done. There's not going to be a treatment for you, you see. This is one of those situations where avoidance has to be the treatment. Because once you have the disease,
it's not going to get better.
There's no treatment. There's no treatment. Now, for some of those patients, the possibility is they may need to have lung transplantation. If your disease is bad enough and there is no treatment, lung transplantation may be the answer for you, or at least...
Except there are not enough donors.
There are not enough donors. And, as we just talked about, 50% of patients with lung transplants will develop the same disease process through immunologic mechanisms. That's one thing I did want to mention. I think I scooted over that a bit. We talked about patients who had bone marrow transplants, and we talked about patients who have lung transplants. There's another group of patients who are subject to this as well, and those are with immunologic type diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and other type and inflammatory bowel disease. Patients with various types of inflammatory bowel disease, whether it's Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, are subject to potentially developing this particular lung disease. And you say, why is that? I can't tell you why is that. The patients with these diseases have a distorted immune system for whatever reason, and that immune system will affect the lung function and potentially cause this disease.
Can that spread to other parts of the body as far as its immune system?
Well, if your immune system is distorted, yeah, you can have a lot of problems, not only from the disease, but the treatments. Because remember, if you have one of these diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, okay, your immune system actually is being pumped up. That's what's causing you to have these troubles. The treatment is to give you medicines that reduce the fire that's in your immune system. Well, now just think of this. Your immune system is the natural system you have that helps you defend yourself against a variety of things, including infections, okay, exposures,
flus, colds,
yeah, viruses, bacteria, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we're always producing cancer cells. We are.
Every day.
Every day. What keeps us from developing the cancer is our immune system, because it recognizes that those cells aren't us, they're something different, and it destroys them.
And I hate to think of people playing God or thinking, well, I know what's best here, because if you turn up this knob here and turn down that knob here, and then you get an unexpected result, so you turn down four other knobs and turn another. Eventually, you're sitting there second-guessing yourself on everything, causing more problems than you started with.
Well, the whole issue with these autoimmune diseases and diseases where there's your body's just creating the problem itself through a hyperactivity of your immune system is that when you suppress that, you suppress some of the good things as well. And patients who have to take those therapies have an increased incidence of, guess what, infections, sometimes unusual infections like fungus infections and things like that that you don't normally get unless you are immunosuppressed. And they have an increased incidence of cancers because the immune system, which normally should take care of those cancer cells that we're always producing, is unable to do that.
Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, The Buzz with Dr. Z. That's Dr. George Lupko, sponsored by the Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania. We're talking about popcorn lung, and we've talked about how vaping, unfortunately, may be a major contributor to it, and there are still people that are developing this, even those that maybe have not worked around some of the chemicals that other folks had done in previous generations. And there is no treatment as in a cure. There's treatment, I guess, for comfort, and that's about it.
Yeah, I thought maybe we'd just wrap this up and make sure everybody understands what we're talking about. Popcorn lung was our topic for today. The real name is bronchiolitis obliterans, Okay. And the reason it's called popcorn lung is not because it looks like popcorn. It's because it was discovered in a factory manufacturing a butter flavoring for popcorn. That was in Missouri in about 25 years ago. Okay. And because of that connection, it got the name popcorn lung. But this disease, as I said right in the beginning of the show, was first recognized in 1901 with a group of people who were exposed to nitrogen dioxide. And they were, and again, this was part of the Industrial Revolution, and they were exposed to this. And they had this disease. They didn't know what it was at that time. It was brand new. That was a new disease, you know. But it was part and parcel of that, the type of respiratory diseases that stemmed out of the Industrial Revolution. And so the idea of popcorn lung, or this bronchiolitis obliterans, now is known to occur in a variety of circumstances. We know that it can occur in patients who have bone marrow transplants, and we know that it can occur in patients who have lung transplants. About 50% of those patients will get bronchiolitis obliterans in their lungs within 5 years, okay? We know that this compound that they were inhaling in Missouri in this popcorn factory was something called diacetyl. Diacetyl has been removed from a lot of compounds now that you breathe, okay? But it is present in many compounds that are used to flavor the nicotine products in vaping.
And it just has something to do with making the flavor that much better.
That's correct.
Whether it's a popcorn butter or whether it's grape or whatever it is they put in the vape.
Yeah, it's like a stabilizing agent. And so you can give yourself this disease by vaping. You can get it naturally if you have some other types of disease, such as rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or some type of inflammatory bowel disease. But the key element to understand about this, and again, this is why it's so important to think about this, and of course not do anything that would give yourself this disease, is the fact that it is irreversible, permanent damage that your lungs sustain, and we have really no treatment for this. We offer patients a variety of things to help, but in general terms, they don't. And many times the patients are just stuck with sometimes needing lung transplantation just because of this.
I don't know how many businesses now are using anything like this where it would be affecting their workers. I'm sure that there are some enclosed places that use chemical compounds that are not exactly the safest thing in the world, but there are regulations on them, and I would hope they're strictly enforced for the workers' sake.
Well, here's what I want to tell you. Well, we talked about this compound diacetyl, which was found in this popcorn factory. But that's not the only compound that may cause this problem. You have this same issue that you have with the vaping smoke is somebody may be exposed in an industrial way to a small amount of this product, but for an extended period of time. These people in the popcorn factory were exposed over a relatively short period of time. Same way with the folks with the nitrogen dioxide. But let's suppose that the exposure is small, that is, the amount is small, but you have a long time exposure to it, 20, 30 years, okay? Well, you're going to get that disease, and if you look back and try and figure out what caused it, you may not be able to put your finger on it because you sample the air and you say, well, it only contained two molecules of this and one molecule of that. Hardly anything, you see.
But everybody's different. Like in the popcorn factory, not everybody developed popcorn lung. Some were, they weren't immune to it. They just didn't get it because their tolerance level was higher for whatever reason. Their body chemistry didn't accept it. But they could develop it 10 years down the road. Who knows?
Well, that's true, too. The point being is that we need to understand that this problem is sometimes difficult to diagnose. And it's difficult to diagnose because the symptoms are those general symptoms that we get with all lung diseases: wheezing, coughing, shortness of breath. Okay, if you have one of those symptoms, or all of them, or some of them, or two of them out of three, okay, you're not going to have to come in and say, I've got popcorn lung. It's a relatively uncommon disease, but taking a careful history, work history, for example, what do you do? What are you exposed to? Or what about your basic habits? Are you a vapor? How long have you been vaping? Okay, what kind of products do you use? Do you use flavored vape products? Those types of historical elements help to define whether or not we think you have this. And sometimes it's the fact that you don't respond to medications that also help to tell us. How would you make the diagnosis? Absolutely. Well, in general, you'd probably have to biopsy the lung. This is really impractical in this circumstance, okay?
But because of how small this is.
Well, the fact that
this portion of the lung.
If you have a disease like this and you have some abnormalities on your CT scan that are consistent with it, you're not responding to medications, and you have a history that would tell us that, yes, this may very well be your situation because you've been exposed to these things, putting you through a biopsy procedure would be inappropriate, okay?
Just to recap some of the symptoms, and this is a listing from the American Lung Association, which we can also put a link to on the podcast of the program. Persistent cough, shortness of breath, especially during exercise, wheezing, chest tightness, fatigue, and diagnosis, as the doctor said, lung biopsy in some cases, but also pulmonary function tests and chest x-rays or CAT scans.
Yeah, pulmonary function studies, really, really important part of the deal. Before we close,
yes.
Okay, I'd like to once again remind the listeners about the Black Lung Clinic.
Yes.
Okay. The Lung Disease Foundation of Central Pennsylvania has a grant from the U.S. Department of Labor through HRSA, and we provide evaluations for patients exposed to coal dust, whether you're a young coal worker, whether you're an old coal worker, and it's free. It involves getting a chest x-ray that's read specially to look for coal dust. It's a pulmonary function studies. There are some lab tests, some blood gas studies that we do. All that's free, and we can refer you on to attorneys and whatnot if you come down with the actual trouble. And we can continue to see you periodically to make sure that this isn't a progressive problem for you.
814-800-2309 is the number. That'll be on the podcast, which will be up on WRTA.com later today. The next show is Tuesday, October 21st at 2 with Dr. George Lupko. Sir, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.